friends, it is James Steensma, and I would like to thank you for joining me for episode 6 of The Art of Letting Go. Today's episode is No Man is an Island, and it's a classic poem by John Donne, but it also serves as the inspiration for this episode, so let's talk about it right now on The Art of Letting Go. I'm not really sure the very first time when I heard No Man is an Island, the gorgeous, so deeply moving poem by John Donne. But I've shared it many times, not only on social media, but also with my classes, with my students. As an English teacher, we talk about poetry and the deeper meaning behind words, the syntax, if you will. But also the interpersonal relationships that I think Donne is speaking of in this poem are hypercritical to us understanding how do we accept things we cannot change and then how do we let it go. Let me share the poem with you. Donne writes, "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as any manner of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." How did Donne's words apply to the idea of letting go? Let's take a look right after this. Well, I'm up late, and that's actually pretty typical for me. If you're like me, you do your best thinking at night, and I certainly do. But it's also fun when you cross a particular threshold and you can say, in my midnight confession, when I tell all the world, and then the song continues, that I love you, so on and so forth. That's a great grassroots song and really has nothing to do with this particular episode outside of the fact that I do love me some 60s music. Here's another thing I will admit to you that I love. Poetry. I am a poetry geek. I'm not a poetry snob, but I am a geek for it. I am about Shakespeare too, so when we get into sonnets, it's a game on. But this one is not necessarily a sonnet. I'm not sure, as I never had the opportunity to study Donne, but I'm not sure this is necessarily a joyous poem. It seems to me like somebody who's on the outside looking in and realizes, perhaps too late, that we're all in this together. And so he's ruminating and, ooh, here's a big word, pontificating on how life could have been, maybe in that catching up. For me, it speaks to a slightly different level because when we talk about interpersonal relationships, when we talk about those moments in between as we have in previous episodes, the knowing that there's a living and a dying, there is a point at which we understand that our own mortality is in play. I think certainly Donne does in this poem, but here's how it applies in my own life. I am very used to being the patient. I am very used to getting poked and prodded, getting blood drawn or having some chemical injected into my body. Whatever the case is, I'm used to it. And so when I see it happen to somebody that I love, and I'm on the outside looking in, maybe like Dunn is at his own life, it gets a little disturbing. It causes me to pause and say, why is the bell tolling, if you will, for them? It's supposed to toll for me. Or at least that's my perception. Now, that's the beauty of poetry, first of all. Poetry nerds versus poetry snobs will tell you that poetry is what it is. This is what I teach my students. Poetry snobs will probably tell you, I'm full of it and there are rules. That's fine. It's fine. My ego's not hurt. But in my case, when I look at poems like this that cause me to take certain words and maybe I am trying to fit it into a particular moment, but there are three that actually stand out when I read a poem like this and I consider my own mortality. And there are three very specifically that stand out, those same three, of course. When I consider that I'm not the only mortal one in the room, how am I supposed to react when someone I love is in a physical condition or a physical danger that I cannot help them with? There's no other real way for me to connect with them on some physical plane except to sit back and look through the window and hope and pray. In my life, I can think of several situations, several, between friends and other family, but there are three that stand out to me that even though I was, for all intents and purposes, a bystander, that action was happening around me and not to me. Each one directly affiliated how I live my life. Each one directly changed my life. They made me more sympathetic. Definitely made me more empathetic. But they also helped to remind me that sometimes in our own lives, we may sometimes try to draw attention inadvertently to our own pains, to our own emotions, to our own needs, and forget that there are other people that are hurting. The result can be somewhat narcissistic when there's hurt in the world and I make it about me. But I do think that you can have something happen around you, and it can still be about you. But as long as you are recognizing the power of those moments to change your perspective. Otherwise, it really is narcissistic. And I'll tell you, it's hard to listen to narcissism. It's hard to listen to victimness. The first of those episodes happened when my oldest son, TJ, was born. I was married to my previous wife. Her name was Gail, by the way. We are very good friends. We dated all through high school. And even to this day, she is very familiar with my wife. I'm very familiar with her husband. We were kids, and we'll talk about that in the future. But nonetheless, while we were kids, we were surprised to learn we would be parents. Our oldest son, TJ, of course, you know, when a child is born, we have a tendency as parents to see nothing but beauty. This miracle of life that you're holding and this beautiful, chubby-cheeked little thing, this human that you're holding in your hands, it's a study in art, right? And when he was born, just like every other child, right, they're perfect, and he was. A few years after he was born, we became pregnant again, Gail and I did, with our second son who was born, and we named him Tyler. But shortly before Tyler was born, TJ had a febrile seizure. You'll have to excuse me. Thankfully, I'm an English teacher and not a nurse or a doctor, so I'll let those of you who are tell me how to pronounce that. It was at that time that he had that seizure, which required hospitalization, that we noticed a tidal shift in TJ's behaviors at home. He seemed slightly more disconnected. He was very gifted, even at an incredibly early age, age of two. We started to see him not only repeat back with intonation, with inflection, the stories that were being read to him by his grandma and grandpa Steensma, his grandma Merriman, or by his mom or myself, or who knows how many aunts and uncles. Whomever it was, he was able to almost mimic them, which isn't necessarily atypical. I think that that's something that happens a lot. After his seizures, we started to notice, though, that he seemed a little bit more distant. He seemed to be in, if you will, his own world. And we started to put these steps and patterns together over the next few years. And finally, in kindergarten, it was at the suggestion of his kindergarten teacher, who was a friend of mine. We had served on committees together in the town we lived in. And she called. She said, James, I really want to tell you. I know this is going to hurt to say, but I feel like there's something different about TJ that may require some additional testing. And of course, as a parent, I said, yeah, of course, he's gifted and talented. And he is. He's 29 years old right now, and he still impresses me with the amazing aptitude he has. But that wasn't the type of testing that my friend Jane was talking about. What she was speaking about was he also seemed distant and in his own world in the classroom. Well, I can remember being very angry at the notion that something was wrong with my kid, right? That's that narcissism I'm talking about, because I made it about me instead of about him. And that's a humanness condition. That's something that happens to a lot of us. Well, you must be judging me as a parent, and I'm not going to tolerate that, right? None of us like to. But Jane, his kindergarten teacher, was such a gentle and sincere soul about what she felt TJ's needs were that I relented. And after talking with TJ's mom, of course, we were still married at the time, but in discussing what our needs were for our son, we really had to let go of the idea that maybe he's not just gifted and talented, but maybe there is something here that we're not seeing, that some test would be able to help us understand better. And so we did have that test done, and TJ was discovered to be on the autism spectrum. So he has an autism spectrum disorder called Asperger syndrome. Well, despite South Park's take on Asperger's, it is actually an autistic condition that allows those people with Asperger's are just socially uncomfortable in many situations. You might call it a social disorder. However you would like to call it, the truth is that those folks have a hard time understanding how the rest of us communicate. in some cases, it gets very disturbing for them. I can only imagine a world today where we're all wearing masks and their ability to communicate as Asperger's syndrome patients. We call them Aspies. Let's just shorten it up. They're Aspies. But all they have to go on is eye contact. That has to be incredibly frustrating. It's like learning a new language. What are your eyes saying? And I remember when we first got that diagnosis and, you know, the immature person in me probably still giggled at the name Asperger's because it is kind of silly. It needs a cooler name. But thinking that, I still don't think that this is my son. I don't believe for a moment that my son has this. These are just tics and innuendo and little dynamics that he's doing that are different than what other kids are doing. But so what? Who doesn't have that? Well, the reality is there are millions of people who don't have that. And it got to a point where we could no longer handle some of the learning situations, some of the physical situations, but most importantly, the emotional situations that we found TJ struggling with. And so we had to seek additional outside help. It helped us as a parent, but when he was diagnosed almost a quarter century ago, there were not many other Asperger's folks near us. What we were told was that he would live a very happy life in a cubicle, maybe doing mathematics, maybe doing some other computer work, something monotonous and mundane, but could be a world changer as long as he was sitting behind a screen on a computer punching in digits. As parents, again, perhaps not putting our ego aside, we felt as though that was not the diagnosis we wanted our child to have. So again, we had additional aptitude tests, and it only reconfirmed what was already known. TJ did have Asperger syndrome. And we molded out a life for him that was not always easy. The teen years, especially the early teen years, were incredibly painful and frustrating, not only for him, but for his mother and for me and for our companions and for his brothers. But most of all, it was painful for TJ. The idea that he had to accept on some level that he was not going to be the same as other kids was more than likely a very damning situation. But at the same time, it's empowering. TJ is one of my heroes. And when you can say that about your own child, you know that they're doing something outside of you. They're doing something greater than what you could teach them. And wonderfully, our son TJ is. The second situation was when our second son, Tyler, was born. Now, again, we were pregnant with Tyler when TJ had his seizures. And it was right around this time that Gail and I started to question if there might be a concern with the pregnancy. It was just a few weeks before he was due, and by all intents and purposes, he was healthy from all the checks and scans and scopes and so on. So it wasn't so much that, but I distinctly remember that for Gail, after we were taking TJ to the hospital for his seizure, I distinctly remember her mentioning pain. And then she kind of shook it off. She was very good at being able to do that. But when Tyler was born, after a labor, by the way, of 24 hours, I'll just say, thank God I wasn't the one trying to push him out. I'd have given him an eviction notice hours before. But when Tyler came out, And I was in the room, and I noticed that the doctors very quickly wrapped around his mid-thigh to belly button area, his whole groin area. They wrapped around a couple of towels, and they whooshed him right out of the room, because he was born from mid-thigh up to belly button region charcoal black. Charcoal black. Not like a bruised skin black. Charcoal black. I actually, when I got a glimpse of him at first, I honestly thought it was hair. Like, holy moly, my child was born a monkey. I didn't know. And I didn't get a good look at him. It's not like they stopped to let us, you know, make googly eyes at him and tell him how beautiful he was. They whooshed him out of the room, and we did not really see him for about 24 hours. Something clearly happened. And here again, I am on that outside, that Dunn suggests, with no real way of helping my own child. But yet, knowing that we are interconnected, not only father, son, knowing that we're interconnected, not only human to human, but that we're interconnected even more closely in a community. The fact that I couldn't reach out and touch this other living human being was very upsetting, because we didn't know what was wrong. There was nobody in the hospital that we gave birth in that had any idea what was wrong, what had happened to our son, that he would be charcoal black from the thigh up to the belly button. And so they reached out to the only place they knew, which would have been IU Med, their Riley Hospital, Children's Hospital Division down in Indianapolis. Believe it or not, somebody there was fully aware of what it was. That doctor's name was Dr. Rink, by the way. And not only had he heard of it, but he had started to perfect surgeries to repair it. The condition was called epispadia. And for all intents and purposes, our middle son was born with an exposed urethra. So whereas men would typically, in their groin area, they would have a pee hole, right? He didn't. He didn't have one. That whole area had not developed. A blood vessel had burst, was all that we were told. And of course, you know, you don't ask why. You definitely don't ask why me, because it's not you that it happened to. It happened around you. But I did sort of ask that question, well, why him? What did he do that would have caused this to happen? Did he commit some sort of pre-birth sin? You know, I mean, your head's just filled with all of these wackadoo notions, because it doesn't make sense. What's the solution? Well, the solution was they would build him a groin out of, to this day, I'm not sure where they got the material, but they did. It took the first year of his life, he had to be on super strong steroids, injections into his back and his shoulder and his buttocks. But at that point, he was strong enough then to be able to have a very massive surgery, which created for him this area that had previously been charcoal was now fully developed, and over time the scarring would diminish and he would be fully functional. And that was true, except for we knew that at some point he was going to have one, if not two, major surgeries. And he did. At year 8, it was right around the time his mother and I had actually decided to divorce. And I'll get into that another episode. But for Tyler, it was important that she and I were together for his surgery, and rightfully so. And So we joined Tyler together when he had to have his surgery again at Riley at 8 years of age to install an artificial sphincter into his groin area, which allowed him to be able to control his ability to pee like a normal person. Actually, he's probably got a little bit better than us because he doesn't accidentally pee when he laughs or sneezes or coughs. And let me tell you, going on 50 years old, it definitely happens. So again, as we look at those two situations, they didn't happen to me. They happened to my children, but they didn't happen to me. And the third situation was even more confounding because it was right in the midst of what was happening to me. And it was, for me, the first time where I'm not talking about a father-child love, but the love that you have for the person you have chosen to share your life with. And that person is going through an immense pain of their own. And you're kind of left trying to figure out how to help them cope while you're still coping with your own condition. I had just received my liver transplant in 2015. And I had been home recuperating for some time. But right around month 2.5 or so, I noticed that Maggie, my wife, seemed as though her abdomen had started to swell. Over time, it seemed as though it not only was swelling, but it was getting rock hard. And that seemed very peculiar to me. I probably mentioned it every night, and I'm sure she probably wanted to put a pillow over my head and just, you know, end it. But she didn't. I persisted. She had called from school on one particular day, I believe it was October 3rd of 2015. And she said she felt as though she couldn't really breathe. She wanted to go to the emergency room. And so we take her there. And in the emergency room, they do a preliminary scan and they said something to the effect of, well, this looks like a small mass that's probably attached to her ovary. We don't believe it's cancerous, but we should probably take a better look. And we'll do that tomorrow. So as we waited later in the evening, they decided to go take a picture of it and came back and said, actually, this appears to be about a 10-inch mass that is attached to her ovaries, and we have concerns that there are additional masses or cysts inside of this cyst, and so we're going to ramp up this. We're going to put her into surgery as quickly as we can. When they got into surgery, and her doctor, her name was Dr. Podjalinski from Fort Wayne, when she got in there and she started to play with this mass, if you will, she drained it of 24 pounds of fluid. The mass, the cyst, had grown to roughly 14 inches by approximately 18 inches, and it had been squeezing up Maggie's lungs and other organs, kind of squeezing them out so that she could not really breathe. So, blissfully, I made up a word there, go with it. But awesomely, Dr. Pod was able to remove that cyst through a very small incision, and Maggie was able to recuperate within about a week. Thankfully, we can say all of this time later, after additional scans, she remains cancer-free, and that tumor was not cancerous. Cancer does run in her family, so you can see why it was of eagerness for her to find out the results of those biopsies and scans. As I consider those three events, it's hard for me, not as the ego me, or not as somebody who might even be slightly narcissistic from time to time. But it's hard for me to let go of the idea that I was not as effectively there for them as I could have or should have been, especially in that situation with Maggie, because I wasn't able to stay with her at the hospital. My immune system had been compromised too much. So here's my wife, who had been by my side step by step, day by day. She has a major surgery, and the one person she wants to have with her cannot be with her. That's one of those guilts that seems to reappear from time to time. Every time she gets sick, I think, okay, now don't blow it. This is your opportunity to really show her how much she matters by showing up. But when I think of, again, Dunn's words, that no man is an island, no woman is an island, the very best I can hope for is that in those times when I am, if you will, island-ish, when I'm stuck in my own little world, that forgiveness comes in the morning. That, again, joy will come in the morning, that we can move on in our togetherness and forgive those moments when I failed to show up. Those are three physical examples of failing, if you will, to show up in a meaningful way. I could have fought for Tyler harder. I could have encouraged TJ more. I could have been there by Maggie's side more. But at the end of the day, that bell is going to toll for each of us. And so we have to make those moments matter. We have to make those minutes count. We have to invest. And more than anything, we have to let it go. Thanks, friends. Special episode coming up next time on The Art of Letting Go. I'm James Steensma. Hey friends, it's James. I just want to encourage you again and thank you for stopping by to listen to this episode of The Art of Letting Go. Know that as we go into the holidays, there's a lot of times where we won't be able to show up. We won't be able to physically be there for the people who need and want us the most. So now more than ever, if you are struggling with the potential guilt of that situation, or a family situation has you anxious or nervous, reach out, grab that phone and text 741-741, the crisis text line, and talk to someone and let them know what's on your heart and your mind and your soul. They will be there to help you. And I'll be here next time on The Art of Letting Go. I'm James Steensma.